Up the top of the show today, I alluded to the horrific week we've had in world news. You may have heard on Books and Arts Daily earlier this week, one of the tragic byproducts of Nepal's earthquake is the damage that's happened to extraordinary cultural and historical buildings. While it's too soon to be thinking about tourism in an immediate sense, the longer-term impact of this kind of loss can be yet another sting in the tail and hugely damaging to a fragile economy of a small country. Dr. David Bierman has worked for 30 years in the travel industry, and he's currently a lecturer in tourism at the University of Technology, Sydney. He also works as part of a consultancy group on travel advisories to the federal government. David, we've seen pictures of the sheer scale of devastation in Nepal. Talk us through some of the immediate implications for Nepal and the Nepalese people.
Well, the immediate implications, obviously, are that infrastructure throughout the country has been incredibly badly damaged. Now, that means that, obviously, the first priority that the Nepalese government has is to look after, firstly, the victims of the earthquake and also, too, to try and repair the damage. So tourism at the moment would be fairly low down in priorities in terms of trying to rebuild it.
And of course, as we see in a place like Christchurch, the kind of aftershocks with an earthquake like this have a huge effect on sense of safety.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. Actually, I was in Christchurch a couple of years ago, and that was nearly 2 years after the earthquake had devastated the centre of that city. And of course, Christchurch has had about 700 major aftershocks, and of course, there are even still aftershocks today. So one of the problems that you have in recovery from earthquakes are, as opposed to, say, recovery from storms, is that you, with a storm as the one that, say, affected Vila, Port Vila in, you know that that storm occurred once, you can recover from that, there may be a storm in the future, but you don't have regular aftershocks. With the earthquake situation, the destruction can actually continue for quite a long time after the major event.
But, I mean, the thing that strikes me, and I agree with your point about travel there not being a kind of priority, but one of the reasons media coverage of this has been as high as it has is the high number of foreigners in Nepal. If it had happened, say, in a more remote part of Pakistan, media coverage would presumably been much less.
Oh, you're absolutely right there. I mean, the interesting thing about Nepal, tourism to Nepal, is that there, in the last year, for example, in 2014, there were about 800,000 tourists. Of those 800,000, about 140,000 are your trekking tourists and your mountain climbing tourists. But the thing is, they come from many countries in the world. And of course, when you have a disaster in which there are casualties from many countries in the world, it creates headlines in every one of those countries.
So that number seems high. I mean, what percentage of GDP for Nepal is tourism? Is it an important
tourism
industry?
Tourism represents around about 4% of GDP. Now, it actually depends whose figures you believe, because the world Travel and Tourism Council will say it represents 7. The Nepalese government actually says it represents 3, and I think they're probably close. It's probably closer to about 4. It doesn't sound like a lot, but what it does do is that tourism in Nepal, because a lot of it's very labour intensive, has actually created around about 500,000 jobs. So this is really what's on the line, that you have 500,000 people who are heavily dependent, directly dependent on tourism, now face a very uncertain employment future.
That's a pretty significant impact. I know that you've done a lot of work and a lot of study looking at other countries and the ways in which they've recovered from disasters. I mean, Thailand, yes, I understand, has been particularly good at getting back on its feet after a disaster.
Well, one thing that Thailand has done, which Nepal hasn't done, and I've followed this, is usually the first type of response that you normally have to a crisis is to let people know what's open, what's operating, what transport routes are available. I just had a look at the Nepal website just before I came to have a chat with you, and the latest update is on the 25th of February 2015. Nothing about the earthquake whatsoever, and I'm very loath to be critical about the people who run the Nepalese tourism website, because they may have been amongst the casualties of the earthquake. But it is very important as a first point of call when you're dealing with a crisis is to actually let people know what the situation is on the ground, and that's something that's clearly not happening in Nepal from a tourism perspective.
I think there, as you say, very much to be forgiven if updating the website is low down their list of priorities at the moment. But I'm curious about that question of attracting people back at the point at which the immediate disaster relief passes. What's the next step?
All right. I think the first step at the moment is that you put a hold on promoting tourism while you're dealing with the aftermath of the damage itself. Now, every major natural catastrophe that I've had anything to do with in tourism, there's generally a hiatus period where you worry about, firstly, making sure that people are all right, that you deal with infrastructure repairs. You call on those organisations who are closely allied with tourism in the area to contribute some funds. And in fact, this has actually happened in Nepal. The International Adventure Travel Association and a number of other organisations have actually banded together to actually raise a lot of funds to help out tourism industries that are going through this distressing period at the moment. The adventure travel industry in particular has a vested interest in that because a large part of the financial income that actually comes into Nepalese tourism actually comes from these organisations. This is where the big money is actually spent. And they've responded actually very, very effectively.
I know that you did a lot of work with the Israeli Tourism Board during the Intifada, which seems like a singular challenge. And and reading some of your stuff, you talk about the kind of three categories of tourists that can roughly be divided.
You have what we call the stalwarts, who are people with a very high affinity and a high commitment to your destination, and they're the people that you start working on first. They're the people who will obviously want to come back. We have a phenomenon that often occurs in tourism, which is called solidarity tourism. So people will come to a place because they feel that the best way that they can contribute to the recovery of that destination is to actually travel. I would certainly suggest in the first instance here is that the people who maybe do come to Nepal come as volunteer tourists, preferably with some skills that are actually useful to Nepal at the moment. You're not going to worry about trying to market to the discretionary traveller who just wants to have a nice, pleasant holiday. They're not going to be coming to Nepal anytime very soon. And other people who generally have a high affinity but not necessarily a high commitment may delay for a certain period of time. But you go when you're trying to attract to recover tourism, and firstly, you need to go to your core market first.
And that core market, you know, I mean, I guess that's another way of thinking about people who are passionate about the place and have a strong personal connection with it one way or the other. That kind of 4% of GDP, the type of people who are normally attracted to Nepal, presumably the trekkers are a big part of it. You're people who are drawn to natural amenities rather than kind of infrastructure questions. Does that mean that their chances of getting back on their feet are better?
They are. They're not going to be dependent, obviously, on structured accommodation. They'll probably be prepared to camp. But I think even those people are going to need some convincing that it is still safe enough for them to travel. I think it's important to recall that in this particular earthquake, it caused avalanches on Everest and obviously many other places as well. So the natural areas were as much affected as the cities and towns and villages.
Look, thank you so much for your insights today. That was Dr. David Bierman from the University of Technology, Sydney. He was also the author of a book back in 2003 called Restoring Tourism Destinations in Crisis, and it's been great to hear from him today. Listeners and viewers of the ABC on any of our platforms would have seen the calls out for your contributions to the Nepal Earthquake Appeal. You can donate directly through Oxfam, who are our partner in this appeal, or via the website, which is abc.net.au/appeal. You can also phone. The number is 1-800-034-034. Funds raised will be spent on desperately needed resources, including clean water, emergency food supplies, shelter, temporary toilets, blankets, underwear, basic toiletries, even urgent healthcare in affected areas, and other emergency relief and recovery assistance for affected families across Nepal. Do give if you can. It's really important. And give either through us or through your preferred charity.